Hello and welcome to the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. I'm Jessica Dahlquist, and I'm so glad you're here today. Today we're following up on part two of our interview with Jackie Shakespeare. Jackie, in episode two, shared with us her journey as her baby Mathis was diagnosed at 6 months old with a terminal disease called SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. And we finished up the last episode. If you haven't listened to it, please go back and listen to episode two or part one of Jackie's interview first so that you have some context. But we just finished up that interview with her receiving that diagnosis with Mathis. And so now we're going to finish up our conversation and continue on and hear what she did from that day forward. She has the information in hand, and now she's about to approach the next day, and she's decided she is going to help Mathis to truly live the rest of his days. And it is so encouraging. The rest of this interview is so hopeful, and she'll go into more detail about how she approached life from then on. So I know you're going to get a lot out of this conversation. If you haven't already done so, please go to iTunes and click subscribe to the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. When you subscribe and when you leave a rating and a review, it really helps other people to find the podcast. And as we're having these amazing moms on the show, it is just my hope that more people will find out about the show and more people will find out about these topics that might really help them along in their motherhood journey. So if you'll do me that favor and please head over to iTunes, I would just really appreciate it. You can also find out more information on our website, www.extraordinarymomspodcast.com, and there you'll find show notes and more information. You can also find my Friday favorites, and you can also see cute pictures of Jackie's family and sweet baby Mathis. So I hope you enjoy the rest of this interview with Jackie, and you still probably want to keep your Kleenex around. Enjoy the show.
I began to think things I wanted to think about things I wanted to do with him and experiences I wanted him to experience. I want to take him to Disneyland and ride Dumbo, and it's a small world. I want to take him to the beach and put his feet in the sand. I want him to feel the waves rush in and to hear the sound of the ocean. We both grew up in Southern California and loved the beach. We would plant shrubs in the day after. I wanted him to feel mud in between his toes and fingers. I wanted him to feel grass on his feet. The simple, everyday things that we take for granted, I wanted him to experience those things. In this short time, he has his body. All of these activities and experiences would also enrich our older boys' lives. This was going to be a happy, memory-filled season of our lives. I woke up and started what I call phase two. I cried as much as I can. I felt the depths of sorrow and pain. I can feel the strength enter my body and spirit. I can feel the peace only the Savior can bring. Everything is going to be okay. He is perfect. Mathis is perfect. Everything about him is a miracle. I wasn't supposed to conceive or stay pregnant on my own. He is living proof that miracles exist. We are now going to live life. We are going to do a lifetime worth of activities and experiences in as little as time as we have together on this earth. It was that morning that I felt I needed to start this blog. We have been blessed with this perfect spirit. All he needed to do was come to earth to get a physical body. The spirit and presence radiates from him. Holding Mathis is like holding a piece of heaven. What did we do to deserve a perfect spirit to come to us? What did I do to have the privilege of carrying a perfect spirit inside my womb? I am humbled. What an honor and a privilege to be called mother, a name I wondered if I would ever hear. We want to share Mathis' spirit and his story because it is one of gratitude, hope, joy, and love.
Whew. Oh, Jackie.
And, you know, there was just this overwhelming pull. It was more than spiritual, more than physical. It was just this pull that just can't be described, and I knew that we needed to share him and to share what this experience was. And normally I'm a completely private person.
Yeah.
Like all of my social media is usually set to private and right. To, you know, because when you're a friend of mine, and when you get me, you get all of me.
Right.
You get the good, yes, the bad, the yes. ugly. It is who I am. And so I don't, you know, try to be something that I'm not. And so it was coming from a very vulnerable place, but I knew that having this blog and having this blog to be public, we could bring hope, and that we could share this perfect spirit that, yes. you know, that we'll likely never have another perfect spirit amongst our family, in our family. And so why not be able to share something? You know, when you feel in your heart, like if you have something that's your favorite or that you love it, mm-hmm. you want to share it.
Yes.
And
yes.
then you want everybody to know about it and mm-hmm. to feel it. And I feel like that's how it was for us. That
Mathis was that favorite thing, yeah. Thing.
Yes, oh, yes. And that I wanted everyone to know and to feel of him. And so we started this hope list. And it was like a baby bucket list, but we called it a hope list. Wow. Because at that point, I feel like in an evolution of gratitude and of kind of thinking of things, we tend to look for things to hope for.
Yeah.
And then once we see things that we have hoped for, then we're able to recognize it and see the joy. And so first we have faith, and then we have this hope, and then, you know, we have this knowledge of something coming or being evident.
Yeah.
And so I had this, at first I had this faith that we would get through it. And then I had this hope that we would live and that we would share all these things with him. And that was my most earnest hope, that he would experience this lifetime of rites of passage as children that we experienced.
So how quickly did you get to that point of, I mean, obviously the diagnosis is devastating, and you're sitting in that doctor's office and you're having that day. How quickly
within
did the...
Within two days. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking
oh
with my grandfather
gosh.
On the phone, and it was before we'd started the blog or anything.
Yeah.
And I called him and told him what the diagnosis was, and he just started crying, and he says, I have to go. He says, I can't handle this. And I said, yes, you can. We can.
Wow.
And I said, and it's not going to be this sad thing about it. I said, we're going to live life, and we're going to enjoy it. And I'm going to take him to the beach, and we're going to take him to Disneyland, and we're going to enjoy life. Because there's no sense in just sitting around the house and watching this baby die. May as well we live while he's here.
And what is that going to teach your other children?
Right.
I mean, about embracing life and appreciating their little brother and building those memories. I mean,
exactly.
Wow.
And on one of these days, I called it... It was hopeless till we drop. It was kind of a weekend.
Yeah.
It was actually... I think it was over a weekend, or maybe even, it's a little foggy for me right now, but mm-hmm. we did all different kinds of things, like we blew bubbles,
and it's simple things. It's simple things
like
you want him to experience in
his
life.
He mm-hmm. had a certain potato casserole dish. We finger painted that day. I think we fed the ducks. We did all sorts of things. And then towards the end of the day, we were finger painting, and for Mathis, he was foot painting, a little bit of finger painting, and our children at the time were 4 and 2,
mm-hmm.
and Mannix, he were coming to the end of this finger painting, and he just yells, I love this world. Just at the top of his lungs, I love this world, and he was so excited, and that's exactly why, like, I knew when I heard that little voice yell those words that that's why I was doing it.
Yeah.
I wanted Mathis to love this world.
Yeah.
This world has such beauty, and it has such amazing, powerful goodness, that I wanted him to see all of the good that this world had to offer. And I wanted our children to enjoy it and not to be in this state of gloom and doom. And I wanted them to have these experiences with him. And that's why I kept this record.
Yes.
Because they were 2 and 4. Our 2-year-old didn't even talk at the time. And he had no idea what was going on and no idea that he would lose this baby brother.
Yeah.
And here's this 4-year-old that just thinks that we are having the time of our lives. We're
like, wow, activities every day? I get ice cream for dinner? Like, this is sweet. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And that was my most earnest hope, is that Mathis felt that as well.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
So we did everything. We had so much help with his hopeless, and we did everything from the local college men's basketball team helped him do a slam dunk. a high school allowed him to be an honorary graduate, so he graduated from high school.
Oh, man.
He ate all kinds of different things. Like, he had his first Happy Meal.
I remember the Dippin' Dots. You know? That really stands out in my mind.
We went to the zoo up in Salt Lake, and he absolutely loved Dippin' Dots. Like, it was the perfect form of ice cream for him. Like, he really was a sweets lover. And he loved, like, you know, candy and ice cream and all of that. But
and he's 6 months old.
Favorite,
yeah.
Right. And
he's like an old soul in his little body.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh.
And, you know, we just had such amazing amount outpour of support and help. And when you're really going through a really huge, difficult point like that, I think the true humanity comes out. And you see the good in the people.
Yes.
And people circle their wagons. And I think especially we as women, we tend to circle our wagons and to build up one another. And you just offer yourself and your whatever you have in your wagon, just like, you know, in old frontier times.
Right.
You offer up whatever you have in your wagon is available. And if they need it, you're willing and ready.
Right.
And I remember when we first got the diagnosis, I had told a friend in town here, and she came over, and I let her in, and she just walked in, she gave me a hug, and we were talking a little bit, and she says, "Keep talking, I'm just doing your dishes." And at that point, I was like, "Oh, please don't do the dishes, just sit and talk to me." But that was something that she could do.
Right.
She identified something that she wanted to help. She didn't really know how, but she knew that that's something that she could do.
Right.
And so,
and you have to let people help. The thing is,
and
like,
that was really, really hard.
Absolutely.
I tend to what I call a service hypocrite. I really, really like
you
to
give,
help
give,
people.
Give, but can't receive.
Mm-hmm. But it's really hard for me to accept and receive help. And I remember when one of those days, my grandfather had called, and he said, "You know, there's something I need to talk to you about, and I know it's not something you want to do, but there are a lot of people that want to help you, and I know you don't like it receiving help, but you need to let them help you."
Yeah.
And that help inspired such unity in my
Absolutely. When we say no, we don't need help, we're robbing somebody else of that ability to feel the sense of pride and contribution that comes from serving.
Exactly.
So just like we get filled up, and I know that you've done that for other people, you have to let other people help you and give to you.
For some reason in my brain, I feel like if somebody helps me, I need to repay them.
Yes, yes.
And that is not what it's about at
all. Absolutely not.
Like, when we, and I don't know why I feel that way, because when I serve, I don't want to be repaid. Like, I just want to, you know, help somebody.
Right.
But in my own internal dialogue, I feel like, okay, so-and-so did this for me, then I need to do that for them.
Right.
But no, that's, we need to get away from that stinking thinking.
Absolutely.
That what it is, what it's about is passing it on.
Right.
Is that paying it forward, is that, you know, when I'm in the position and I can help somebody else that's in need in some other way, then I give of myself then.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what is so amazing, is that all of our cups become full and we're never drained because we're constantly paying it forward. And somebody else is paying it forward to you. And that, I think, is a real hard thing for us, is to just accept it and say thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And without that guilt or that, you know, need to repay.
Absolutely.
Because...
absolutely. And I think people, sometimes they'll see somebody in need and think, oh, well, I don't know what to do. But just do
and
what you do best.
People
do the dishes.
Since then.
So what are some things that
people... since then, so things, what should you do? And a couple of different friends have called and say, you know, I have a friend who whose baby passed away, or they had a stillborn, like, what should I do?
Right.
And I tell them, I say, you know what? What you do doesn't matter as much as that you do it.
Right. Right.
It doesn't matter if you take a loaf of bread, or if you take a meal, or if you just go and talk to them. What matters is that you did do it, that you did make that effort, that
right.
you did open that communication, because I have been guilty of that on the other side, where I just didn't know what to do.
So you did nothing, right?
That had a miscarriage, or she had a stillborn baby, actually, in the same community that I met you in, and it was before I had ever had children. I just didn't know what to do, and so I was almost paralyzed in this fear, this unknown, that I didn't want to do the wrong thing,
yeah.
And so I didn't do anything.
Right.
And not doing anything is the wrong
thing. Is worse. It's worse.
Yes, yes.
And it's fine to say, I care, I know that nothing I do or say can make it better, but I'm here.
Right.
Or what,
right.
you know, I care about you. I'm thinking about you. That's the
Absolutely.
Best thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so no matter what situation you come into, give of yourself what you have to give.
Mm.
Offer of yourself what you have to offer. And be willing that they won't accept it, but do something that you can just kind of do it and just kind of leave it there for
right.
them. I remember we received some friends had sent that were far, far away, actually in a different country, but they had sent some gift cards
yeah.
for different places, you know, for like quick, you know, something to eat. And that was a huge blessing because
right.
it's not things that you even think about,
right.
you know?
It's one less thing to take off your plate. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things that are helpful for the kids, or an activity for other children that are there, or a meal. And one thing, one of my friends that was here, she was like, I know that you won't really say yes, so that's why I made you a freezer meal, and I'm not saying no, and I'm not taking it home. I'm just going to come in.
Just going to leave it here.
Put it in your freezer,
uh-huh.
and you can use it when you need it.
Yep. And just
sure
say
enough,
thanks.
We needed it,
yes.
you know?
Yeah.
And I think that at sometimes we, when we ask for help, we kind of equate that with being needy or vulnerable or, you know, lacking the strength that we once had.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually communing your love with theirs.
Oh, that's
that
beautiful.
That you are loving them enough to let them in.
Wow.
At your darkest, in your most vulnerable state, that they are saying, I love you and I want to help you. And you're saying, thank you. I love you too. And I accept
yeah.
what you have to give.
And when you view it like that, how can you possibly
right.
walk away from somebody just because you don't know what to say?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we had received so much help and so much service that we would go to the mailbox. We have a mailbox hub that's
mm-hmm.
down at the end of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we would walk by this this house each time, and they had some weeds that were growing, and it was quite a weeded area. And you know, instead of thinking, walking by and thinking, oh, they need to weed, I thought, the heck they do. We walk by it every day.
We've got hands. Oh.
And so each day we would grab our little grocery bags and we, you know, would put the kids in the stroller, the little ones, and we would park Mathis since he would see us, and we would go down and we would pick weeds, and I would pray that nobody would look out, that like the kids weren't so noisy, that because I didn't want them to know who it was.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know who they were, and we didn't want them to feel bad.
Right, right.
And so we just did it little by little.
Wow.
And it was the best feeling, especially to do something that simple at the same time that we were receiving so much service. Does that make sense? Like
oh,
we,
yeah.
I still needed to fill my own service cup.
Well, and it's so metaphorical. Of course you're picking weeds. You know, you're just like cleansing yourself and purging that soil of the stuff that you don't need in your life.
Right.
And just making it whole and making it rich and making it good. And that's where you were at in your life. Just clinging to what was so good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So your hope list, did you come up with all those things as a family? Did you ask your kids? I mean, I know only Mannix was really old enough to
No, it was just my husband and I.
Okay.
We sat there one afternoon and...
How many things did you come up with initially?
I can't even remember. I don't even remember how many we had on the list total.
There was a lot, but it was everything from, you know, finger painting and sticking his toes in the mud, swimming,
so
oh my gosh.
All in total, there were about 62.
Okay.
And I want to say that we did more than half.
Wow. So he was 6 months old when he was diagnosed, and you, within 2 days.
He passed away, yes, and so we got all those, and then he passed away by the time he was 8 months old.
Wow.
And so we had done, you know, quite a few things here at home and locally.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a lot of things when we went to Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was simple things. Like, one of them was driving in L.A. traffic. Never in my life had I ever been grateful for traffic.
Right.
And at this point, I was praying for traffic. Please let there be
a
traffic
jam.
You've
got to check this one off.
Yes, yes, please let there be a traffic jam. And we also went sledding. So he was diagnosed around April. It was like the end of March, beginning of April, right around Easter time.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up into some local mountains in Brianhead. And there was still snow in May. No, April, I believe it was.
It was meant to be.
And we sledded.
Yeah.
And we were sledding in May in southern Utah. Like, that is
unheard of.
But we received all of these tender mercies and all of these, you know, little things that it was amazing. And we would have, you know, messages from people like, what can I do to help?
Right.
What can I do to help your hope list? Or they would see something on the hope list and they would offer help. Like, we had a friend going through undergraduate school. It was a really good friend of my husband's named Kyle, and he just happened to have two horses, and we were going to be going up into that part of the state, and he offered for us to come and ride his horses, because that was one of the things on the hope list, was to ride horses, because my grandmother growing up, she'd always had this love of Clydesdales, and they were just this majestic animal.
Massive,
that was just
yeah.
bigger than life. And so I'd always had a huge respect for horses, and that's kind of a rite of passage. Like, you know, even a lot of people don't even get to ride a horse.
Absolutely.
In their lifetime.
Yeah.
And so for that to be you know, something on his list that he did was incredible, but more so was the interaction between he and this horse, Sam. And this huge horse, I don't know how they measure horses, but he was a large male.
Uh-huh.
And he knew that there was something different or something wrong with Mathis. And I know that they do equine therapy with kids with special needs. But I tell you, there is a
definite sixth sense
with animals, and knew. And he, you know... He was, you know, trudging along, and then as soon as he came up to the baby, he came up to him and with the sweetest nudge, and would smell him and kind of nudged him. And then when it came time for Mathis to ride him, we held him as we rode, but he trotted. He didn't trot. It was more of a glide as he carried him, and it was almost as if he knew that it was this noble responsibility that he had that day,
like a chariot.
He elongated his neck, and it was almost like he had this royal duty. And it's interesting to actually find out that he ended up getting sick and passing away as well.
Really?
And he had to be put down. But I, you know what I mean? It's just
yeah.
this, and when you are in the thick of these things, you could be focusing on all of these negative things, and oh, I have to have a suction machine to suck the mucus out of my son's lungs, or oh, we have to, you know, have these different interventions, or I had to have a hospice nurse come in and, you know, evaluate him for the day before we were able to do this.
Yeah.
But instead, it was just such gratitude that we were able to do it.
Wow.
That we, you know, were able to have all of this happen. And, you know, even down to going to the mortuary, like, that is not some place that you want to go. But we made the appointment to go to this specific mortuary, and there was some miscommunication, and the funeral director that was there was just in his street clothes and wasn't, you know, dressed up. And he says, oh, I apologize so profusely. Normally I'm in my suit and I'm, you know, I look more professional, and I really apologize. And I said to him, I said, nope. I said, it was meant to be this way because this is exactly what I needed.
Yes.
I needed a father. I needed somebody that I knew that I can trust with my baby.
Mm-hmm.
And you
just a man
in a suit,
not
yes,
a business.
I needed you
yeah.
as the individual,
mm-hmm.
and not you as a funeral director. And he cried and cried and cried. And I remember after Mathis passed away, he came to the house and took him, and he cried the whole way home, or
wow.
the whole way to the funeral home. And he took the most exquisite and best care of my baby that you wouldn't even imagine.
Wow.
And I remember walking in to the viewing room after his body had been prepared for burial. And there was this extreme sense of not separation, but of a weight off of my shoulders. Because at that point, I had realized that because when he after my son passed away, after Mathis passed away, his spirit had not left yet. It was still,
and you were
here,
and you were
still,
holding him.
I held him when he passed away in
oh.
my arms.
Oh.
But in our bedroom, and with our wonderful doctor, pediatrician here with us. But after he passed away, it was like he took my baby.
Oh.
But then when I went to go see the body that was prepared, it wasn't my baby anymore. It was just a body that held my baby's spirit.
Wow.
And so it was like this release of responsibility that this spirit was no longer in this body.
Right, right.
And so I am really, really appreciative that he was the person that
the caretaker.
Was able to take that body
yes.
and that the spirit was allowed to be released from that body at some point. And so
wow.
it was really an incredible, incredible experience. And I think that had we met him in any other state, it wouldn't have been that same way.
Wow.
And so that was particularly powerful. And I see, you know, I tend to call myself a positive realist.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've got that logical side from my grandfather, very linear. And, you know, 1 + 2, 1 + 1 = 2, and, you know, straight from point A to point B.
Right.
But then I tend to think of the positivity and of the silver linings and of all of these different things. And so I think that while I do recognize that this did hit me and that this is going on, there were all of these positive things that were happening all around it.
Wow.
And it made it not as bad. I remember when we went to look for, after he passed away, we went to look for burial clothes for him. Because that was one thing that, you know, as much of a planner, he was still growing, and he was still, you know, getting really long and tall.
And you didn't know how
and
long,
I didn't
how,
know how
much
long
longer
he
had,
be
yeah.
by the time he passed away. And so we went to this place to get, you know, some burial clothing for him. And I walked in, and I couldn't say anything. And she came up to me, this little gal came up to me, and an older lady, and said, "What can I help you with?" And here I am staring at these, you know, infant burial clothes, and, or clothes, you know, and I said, "I need to find a suit to bury my baby." And the compassion and the love and the sisterhood and the communion of her heart with mine,
yes,
was unlike any other. She was a complete stranger to me, and I couldn't recognize her off the street if, you know, if I tried.
Right. But in that moment.
But at that moment.
Yes.
She was the angel that I needed. And she just said, you know, "How old is he? How big is he?" And that was it.
Yeah.
And the rest of it, she held my hand. And, you know, she did exactly what she needed to do.
Right.
And I think that's what's so important, is that we listen to that inner voice, that, you know, whether you call it your conscience or your sixth sense or your, or the spirit or anything that you call it, whatever it is, that you heed that and that you follow it, because it's something that is bigger than we are, and it is something that speaks on a greater and a grander level, and you don't recognize it unless you follow through with that.
I mean, on a daily basis, you don't have to be going through something really hard. On a daily basis, there are just things like, for instance, going on around us that we can choose to notice or not, or choose to embrace, or choose to listen to, or not.
Right. But, yeah, like one day, I was passing by the donuts, and I had a thought, "Oh, I should pick up a box of donuts and take it to so-and-so." And then I thought, "Well, that's ridiculous. Like, why would they want donuts? Like, this is silly." And so then I'm going through and getting all of my produce, and these donuts are over here in the bakery next to the produce, haunting me, which, you know. And so then I think to myself, I just need to go and get the donuts. It doesn't matter why.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that whether they may or may not want them. I felt the need that I needed to do it, and so I need to do it. And so, sure enough, I bought the donuts. On the way home, I dropped them off, and I said, "I just here? Felt like I needed to bring you some donuts." So here they are. And that little face lit up so bright. Oh. And, you know, whether they needed them or not, or whether they knew or not that they needed them, was regardless of the fact that I listened to that little thought that said, "You need to do this."
Yes.
And so I think it's, you know, listening to that, identifying first that it is, you know, it's not a silly thought. It's not something that should just be, you know, brushed
it's
away.
It's not about the donuts.
Right. Yes. Exactly. It has more to do about the person than the actual act. And so I think that, you know, we received so much love. And I think that the most helpful thing were the prayers, because we literally did not feel ourselves. We felt an incredible amount of strength and fortitude and, you know, just this overwhelm, almost like that we had worked out and that we had prepared for this, but really we hadn't.
Right.
But we were fortified in that we had this built up energy and strength and hope and faith that was not just us alone. Like, there was more to it than that. And that is what the strength of prayers mean. And that is what the strength of a community means.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's what it's all about, is, you know, we're all in this together. And if we can help to get somebody through it a little bit easier than they had the day before, then why not let's go for it? And why not, you know, try to find the positive in things?
100%.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I mean, and everyone, there's a fork in the road for everyone. If they get bad news, there's a fork in the road. You know, you can choose to wallow, and you're warranted in that. You're allowed to feel sad and feel grief and have
absolutely.
That.
Yeah.
But then there's also a time where you can choose to go a different way and embrace life this new way and accept it's going to look different, but we're going to keep going because life is worth living. And yeah. as you've shown with Mathis, it's like, it doesn't matter how many days he had left on this earth, each day was going to be embraced. And in turn, your whole lives, you and your husband and your other boys, all their lives were enriched. Right. And in turn, when you shared with other people, I mean, right now I'm making like circles with my hands. Like, you can't see me, but you know, it's like, it starts with you, right. but then it just has this contagious. Ripple effect. And as yes. you share what you're noticing, as you're accepting service and giving, you know, the messages of hope and everything, I mean, it just expands and the reach is just so far.
Yes, absolutely. It's that paying it forward.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And of anything to pay forward, it's joy.
Beautiful.
You know, like we established this hope list, and we did this hope list, and I, you know, after a certain point, like you go through grief, and, you know, textbooks would have us believe that grief is this very step-by-step that you right. go through each of these steps of mourning and of grief. And you go through the denial, and then you go through, you know, the anger, you go through all these different steps, mm-hmm. and you go through it in the orders that it shows on the flow
chart. For a certain length of time, and, yes, yeah, and then move
absolutely.
On. Mm-hmm.
And that is the biggest fallacy that I could ever explain to anybody. Mm. Grief really looks like a pen that a toddler has taken and has scribbled all over the page. Imagine, it is just everywhere.
Yeah.
That's what grief is like.
Right.
You can be at any one point, and you can be walking along or driving along, and everything is fine, and then all of a sudden, you have this huge trigger, or it could be a tiny trigger
yeah.
that lets out this huge flow of emotions and
right.
of grief. Just this past September is actually what was a big trigger for me.
Hmm.
At the beginning of the school year, I have to kind of tell the teacher that, you know, we had a child pass away, and once in a while there's a trigger for, you know, Mannix or Mason,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, once in a while they just need a hug, or they get sad, or, you know, whatnot, that they're still, you know, going through the grieving process,
right.
just to let you know, so you're not, you know, taken aback by it.
How long has it been since he passed away?
And then it had been about 2.5 years.
Okay, 2.5. Okay.
Yeah, because he was...
Wow,
he
I
was
can't believe that.
At the time, right.
Wow, okay.
He would have been 3 in September.
Wow.
And so I remember sitting in back to school night, and then Mannix's teacher, and it was, you know, a little bit after the commotion had died down, and a lot of parents had left, and I, you know, started to tell her, you know, about, you know, we had a baby that passed away, you know, 2.5 years ago, and the floodgates just started. And they just broke, and tears just came, and I didn't plan it.
Yeah.
It was most embarrassing moment that I've had in a long time, because normally I can grieve, and I can call a friend, or I can, you know what I mean? Like, I
yeah.
can do it in my own private sense. I can
right.
be angry, I can, you know, go in the shower and wail and yell and
right.
still be semi-private.
Right.
But here I am before this brand new teacher.
Back to school
no
night.
Who I am.
Right.
Who,
she's like, what did I do? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I just cannot stop crying. Just tears just keep continually flowing. And I'm like, I'm normally not like this. But that particular moment was just a tip of an iceberg.
Mm.
I didn't know it was there. It just seemed like a little surface thing. And then before I knew it, it was this big, bigger than life thing where I went into kind of like a little, you know, not this seasonal. I think they call it a seasonal depression because it was around the same time that he passed away.
Mm.
And so, you know, like I was explained to by a grief counselor that grief is kind of like sitting or standing in a tide. And so, like, you're at the beach and the tide is, you know, rolling in, and you sometimes the waves come in and the waves of grief will come. And at first they'll be, you know, really close together and really hard, and it'll keep knocking you down. But, and then soon, a little bit while afterwards, they get a little bit further apart. and then eventually they get a little bit less intensity and they're further apart. And, you know, each time after you get hit by a wave, like, you keep getting up. And then once in a while, you'll think that, you know, the way the ocean is completely crystal clear and flat, and then you'll be hit by a rogue wave. And it doesn't matter that you're knocked down, but what matters is that you get back up.
And find that footing. Yeah.
Yep, you get that footing, and you dig deep, and you get back in it. And I used to have this theory that, you know, like, time, like, when we hear it often, like, time heals all wounds. And I don't believe that. I believe it's what happens in that time. I believe that we have to do the work in order for the healing to come. And it's not just time in itself. Yeah. It's the actual practices and rituals and exercises that we do within that time. And so it's very much more of an active process than an inactive process, because, you know, it can be 2 years for me and I seem to be to feel like I have a handle on it, whereas it could be 10 years for someone that is still in the depths of grief,
right?
And it's just not, it hasn't happened for them yet. That active process
right.
hasn't happened for them, and I think that that's what was such a huge blessing, because after Mathis passed away, it was just six weeks later, I had this overwhelming feeling that there was one more baby, and I thought,
and you thought you were done with him.
You have yeah. got to be kidding me.
Yeah,
I have just gone through this. Like, you know, and I believe in a higher power, and for me, my higher power is God. And here I have these feelings that God has another baby to send me. And I am thinking that he has lost his everlasting mind.
Like, I've really tried to stick with you on this whole trial, God, but now you've lost me.
Do you remember what I've been through? Like, yeah. have you not seen it all in, you know,
right.
in first person? Like, this is insanity. Like, why would I do this to myself? And I'm fighting this feeling for a week. And each day it gets worse and worse. And my heartbeat starts to get faster and harder. And I get to the point where I just can't stop it anymore. And I say to my husband, I think that there's another baby. And he was like, I know. And I thought to myself,
when are we going to tell me?
Class?
Yeah.
Right? And so he had known, you know, for quite a long time that there was one more. And that was really hard. And so then I come to the end of the week and I say, okay, you know what? We're going to do it. And we have a 25% chance that this baby is going to have SMA. But guess what? The only thing that this baby needs, this spirit needs a body. And if this spirit is perfect, just like Mathis, and just needs to come here to get a body, we can do that. We've been through it before. We can do it again. We know wow. how to do it. We are equipped.
There was no fear?
I was more afraid of what other people would think
oh, interesting.
Than what I thought.
Interesting.
There was definitely a compulsion for me that I knew that it needed to happen. And for me, and so we go to the doctor, the same doctor that delivered Mathis, and I said, well, we need to have another baby, and I said, talk to me about it, and he said, I don't even know how you're in this office. He says, here you are, 6 weeks out, and by rights, you should just be, like, in puddles of grief.
Right.
And here you are.
Standing.
Being
with your footing.
And ready to handle this again.
Yeah.
He says, you know, I have, you know, a personal interaction with a family that had a child pass away, and 2 years later, they are still in the depths of the grief, and here you are 6 weeks, and you're wanting to do this again. He says, I can't explain it, I don't know, he says, but I'm here with you and whatever you want to do.
Wow.
And so, with our particular situation, it's not... I don't know how common it is for people to have a diagnosis of SMA and then go on to have more children. Because the facts are very real. You roll those dice and it's 1 in 4 every right. single time. Which then, going back to the beginning, the reason I miscarried was SMA.
It was like natural selection for those mm-hmm. babies. Wow.
And really, what I saw, especially after that fourth one, the one before Mason, that fourth one where I drove home angry at God, when I felt he was denying me of what I felt I was wanting so much, he was actually protecting me. Oh. And I had no idea. He was protecting me from it until I was at a place, and I was in a place both maturity-wise and support system-wise.
Yeah.
And developed and ready to be able to tackle it. Could you imagine if I would have had a baby with SMA when we were in college?
10 years ago? Right.
Yes,
no, absolutely.
That would be destroying.
Absolutely.
Instead, what I thought was him depriving me of a blessing was actually a protection and a blessing.
Wow. Imagine if we just trusted that whatever happens in our life is meant to
right.
be at that moment, and we could really rest in that at that time, instead of
right.
just relying on, okay, in hindsight, we know things will work out or whatever, but what if we could just cling to that now instead of
right.
waiting for that to come? Wow.
Exactly. And so then here we are, and I remember having a conversation with an individual in my family, and we told them that we were going to try one more time, that we felt like we really needed to. And they told me that I was being selfish.
Wow.
And I thought, whoa, of anything, I would think that this would be one of the least selfish things that I could
yeah.
be doing.
You're willing to risk it.
And they said, well, I haven't even grieved the loss of Mathis yet, like, I can't do this again.
Wow.
And I thought, this has nothing to do with you. This has everything to do with this baby that is supposed to be here.
Mm.
And so we go and we decide that we're going to get pregnant, and easy as comes as ever. It was just like
wow.
getting pregnant with Mathis. Like, Mathis, we didn't know, but with this one, came super right away. We were pregnant, you know, right when we
wow.
tried, which was a miracle in itself, because we had miscarried
right.
4 times. Like,
right.
there's no way this is a normal... Sorry, we had an Amber Alert. There's no way that this was a normal, you know, event for us. And so I was pregnant, and we go back to the doctor, and they say, wow, you don't mess around. Like, well, this baby's meant to be here, and I'm telling you,
yes.
he's coming.
And it's going to be a boy.
You know, and as soon as I was pregnant, I knew he was a boy, and I was pretty sure he was healthy.
Hmm.
And so we go to the doctor, and I said, he's a boy, and he's healthy.
He just so you know.
Like, I had 3 eyes.
Yes.
Like, all right. Like, whatever. So we keep going to the doctor, and I keep, because, you know, one of the other doctors was quite emotional about it, and, you know, had quite a stir of emotions. And I remember I saw him before I was to receive my amniocentesis to see if, you know, the
yeah.
baby had it. And for me, I wanted to know, because, you know, and it sounds kind of morbid or kind of, you know, insensitive, but I needed to know, do I need to buy a crib, or do I need to prepare to buy a casket? Like, this is
wow.
just a thing that I need to know. I can't go the whole 9 months not knowing for positive. I feel in my heart that everything's okay, but you never know. You could
right.
just be hoping that everything's okay.
Right.
And so, and he says, well, the only thing I can do is get you that test done as soon as possible. And, you know, and I said, and I told him, and I started to get tears in my eyes, and I said, and I looked at him, And it was almost as if I was comforting him, and I said, if this baby has SMA, it's okay. And he just wept. And he was like, and he took the tissues that normally you give the pregnant woman.
Right.
And he's like, you're not supposed to make me cry. But he knew that was true.
Right.
And that baby was meant to be here. And so we had this amniocentesis, and I was petrified. I thought, I've come this far with this baby. He's feeling like he's normal, like he's, you know, more active. He's staying, you know, where he's supposed to. Dear God, please do not let this doctor, like, poke the baby or do anything to jeopardize the baby with this amnio. And everything comes through, and I'm reading it through with her, and she was like, yeah. She was like, this is a negative test. She was like, he is SMA-free. And talk about joy.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
Joy in my heart was so, so immense that it just, I couldn't believe it. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
I knew it, but you can't believe it. And there's a difference between knowing and believing.
Yes.
And so, you know, I go to the doctor, I call the doctor and talk to the nurse, and I said, tell him, I said, the baby's a boy and he's healthy.
Yeah, I told you. Yeah, right.
Right? And so the doctor gets on the phone, and he is just so, he's as excited as we are.
Oh.
And he is just relieved. And it was at that moment that we told everybody that we were pregnant. We had kept it from, you know, except for Dwan's mom and I think my grandfather. And so we had kept it a secret, which is easy when your family lives out of town.
Yeah.
But we had kept it a secret and then announced that we're having another baby. We had this compulsion that there was one more spirit that needed to come, and he's completely healthy. And I think that there was like this collective communal sigh of relief.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, oh my gosh. But something that's funny is that even though I knew this, I knew it in my heart, I now believed what the medical science was telling me and this genetic test. But even up until him being born, I needed to hear that cry. Mathis never had a startle reflex. I needed to see this new baby, his name would be Madden. I needed to see this new baby have a startle reflex.
Yes.
I needed to see him lift his head.
Start out on a different path,
to see all of these physical, you know, evidences that this was really true, that everything that you know, that you believe, and that you see is true.
Wow.
And, you know, he had a little bit of a delay in his motor development, and it scared me like you cannot believe.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, he didn't crawl until I think he was 12 months old. And that, by rights, is kind of a later crawler.
Right.
He didn't walk until he was 18 months old. And so for me, it was like, okay, this DNA test says that he doesn't have it. And he's sitting up and he's doing all these things, but could something else be wrong? Because let's be honest, we have won the genetic, you know, jackpot in the negative way.
Right.
And we, you know, if we could get this, we could get something else too. But sure enough, he was just on his own little timeline, and he did what he wanted to do when he wanted to do it.
He came around to it.
And now he's, you know, 21 months old. He's going to be 2 in April, and he is living and breathing and crying and drinking and, you know, he's
making messes and doing all the things that little boys should do.
Well, and after just coming off from having Mathis, who was a 25% miracle, that he's even alive and was with us, and he was, you know, he presented with SMA, and then we go to the opposite miracle, that this baby is not even a carrier.
Oh, really?
Yes, he's not even a carrier.
Wow.
And so, like, going from complete polar opposites, and now knowing that the genetics for his children from his side will never be railed.
Go down that
SMA.
Road. Wow.
Right. You know, of course, in future generations, it could happen. Right. But, you know, as of right now, there is no cure for SMA. there are drugs and research and everything going on in the drug pipeline, and they're doing the best that they can with Cure SMA.
Mm-hmm.
Is the group, is the, you know, foundation that an organization has come to try to rally with, with fundraising and with research and with, you know, funding these researchers to do all kinds of things. And they're making, you know, great strides, and I hope that one day that we can say that there is a cure. But, you know, for something to be such a horrible and devastating experience, it was one of the best experiences of my life.
Wow.
It brought greater joy, and it brought greater meaning and happiness than I even realized. And I think now, so more so getting off of the antidepressant and really being able to feel that joy, is where you can fully embrace it. Like before, with Madden, I could love him and I could snuggle him, but it was just still kind of flat. But now I'm able to see, like, him for what he truly is, and to see him and to just enjoy and to relish in his existence is just this miracle baby. And I think that an interesting thing is how each of the children kind of process the grief. And for our oldest, like, they are very well adjusted to grief and to passing away. Like, it's not a fear at all. We talk about it. And we talk about it in a sense that he's your brother. Mathis is always going to be your brother. He will always be with you. If you ever, you know, miss him, we could just say a prayer and we can, you know, tell God that we love him and that we miss him. And, you know, and so we don't have to be sad or afraid. And then he'll know that we miss him. And with my oldest, he, you know, recognizes that we have three, that we do have four boys, and that he does recognize that Mathis is a brother, but he recognizes that there are three living. And so, you know, but our younger, our second child, Mason, who is about to be five, he will not accept the fact that there are three children in the family right now. He will always say that there's four.
Really?
Anytime.
What do you say? Like, if you're meeting somebody new.
It depends.
Okay.
For me, if I'm in line at the grocery store, and I don't really want to get into it at
right,
the grocery
right.
store, I'm going to say, I've got three boys, yes.
Yeah, one, two, three. Yeah.
What you see, yep,
count
what I've
them.
Got.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm building a stronger or a deeper relationship with somebody or a friendship, then, you know, and they ask and they say, well, we did have a child that passed away, another son. Or if they come into our house, they'll see
pictures.
You know, a picture that we have that has all of us, and it actually has our oldest holding a picture of Mathis.
Which
and so
I
they'll,
love.
They'll kind of figure it out. Yeah. They'll say, well, now who's this? And, you know. And so it kind of is an evolution of,
okay,
of a relationship.
That makes sense.
But every single time, if Mason is with me at the grocery store, and they'll say, oh, do you have three boys? And I'll say, yeah. And he will pipe up louder.
Nope.
No, we don't. We have four boys. We have Mathis. He passed away. He's in heaven. And he will not allow me to say that we have three children. And it's completely personal. Like, my current physician, my physician that took care of Mathis, she has since moved on and moved away, and so I had to get another pediatrician, and which is, he's also fantastic. And he actually lost a child, and so we have kind of bonded over that. He has kind of helped me along through, because he also had subsequent children after his child passed away.
Oh, wow.
And so that's kind of a whole new territory, too, is understanding what it's like to have a baby after a loss.
Right.
And to feel that anxiety of, like, you know, I've come this far, like, don't, like, let this baby just be perfect.
Right.
Don't let anything happen. And so I asked him, and, you know, you kind of ask somebody else that's been through it, like, how do you navigate through this?
Right.
And he said to me, he says, you know, for me, I always say, and it just, you know, as an example, I always say I have five. And just one's not with us. And he was like, that's my answer for me. He says, for you, that might not be the answer.
Hmm.
You know, 20 years from now, it might be a different answer.
Yeah.
But you have to do what feels right for you at that time.
Right.
And I remember when Mathis was diagnosed, like, I felt this immediate pull to move his crib into our room. And our pediatrician, she says, then do it. All of those things that you feel like you need or that you want to do, do those. And I think that that's what's important, is that, you know, even if that's what feels right to you for a specific moment while you're going through that grief, or while you're walking through that trial, that you honor that, and that you recognize it, and that you take a moment to just live that, and to go through that step and that process.
Indulge yourself in that.
Yeah. And so then, and that's all part of it, and that's the work that I'm talking about.
Right.
That is the work that you have to do within the time.
Mm.
And it's those things that it's just conscious everyday things, like, you know what? No, today it just doesn't feel right, or I don't need to share this with somebody.
Right.
And part of me, I am Mathis's mother. However, I don't want the label of the lady whose baby died.
Mm.
I want the, you know, the sense of being that I am my own person, and that we are our experiences, but that's not all we are.
Oh,
we are also our triumphs, and we are also our victories.
And you are the lessons that you've learned from that experience.
Right.
So you're not just...
You're not the label of your lesson, but you are this...
You personify what
lesson.
You've learned.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a little while ago, I wrote, I no longer keep the blog. I did turn it into a blog book.
Good.
A blurb book. And so... It's a hardbound book that we've got that I can share with our kids once they get older, and once they can, you know, kind of process it for themselves and see what it was like that they were just, you know, a toddler and a preschooler at the time. But recently I did a Facebook and Instagram post that said, moving from hopeless to joyless. It says, we're coming upon a significant day of our little family. September 8th is Mathis's birthday. This year would be 3, and this was just this past September. I still can't believe it. I've been texting a wonderful friend about Mathis and the emotions we've both had. The good, the bad, and the ugly. That's what happens when you know me. You get the real me, glitter and smiles, along with the tears and mascara running. I digress. I'm writing this to share with you. All of you have loved and prayed for us in Mathis, to you who cried the ugly cry with us and the joyful belly laughed with us, to you who mourned with us and carried our yoke, to you who breathed a sigh of jubilation when our next SMA free angel came to be. P.S. He's walking now, like really walking.
Oh.
I digress a lot. During my texts with friends, I tend to type as I think. As I was typing, I told my friend that all of the pain and sorrow we each go through and experience is necessary so that we can appreciate the joy. I lay here writing this from the room where Mathis passed away, where I held him in my arms, and as I type, Madden is walking in and out, chatting away with his cute little chortle, the same room where I felt the deepest despair. I now feel one of my greatest joys. I haven't wanted to do anything on our hope list for a long time. It still hurts. It hurts to be doing it without Mathis. It's like picking at a raw wound, a wound that just needs to be what it needs, be what it wants. It feels like we've elevated past hope, and we need to focus on joy, finding joy in the journey, finding joy in the future, finding joy in the past. Finding joy in the gospel, finding joy in our season, choosing joy, looking for joy. So with this post, we begin writing our joy list. Maybe it will have some of the things, same things as our hope list. Maybe it won't. But I do know one thing. It's not for Mathis. It's for us.
Mm.
It's just what we need, and it will evolve as we continue to evolve and grow. Thank you for your love and compassion and tenderness. And I just recently found this little inspirational, you know, message quote and, mm-hmm. you know, floral thing that I just loved. And it says, be filled with joy. And, you know, I think that that's so poignant that it's not to have joy or to look for joy, but to be filled with joy. And, you know, sometimes we'll be half full, and sometimes we might be, you know, three quarters full, and sometimes we might be all the way full, but it's to fill yourself with joy. And I feel like to fill myself with joy is to recognize those, you know, fabulous realities, these little, tender mercies, or these things that happen that are silver linings in our lives, that if you choose to find those things is what makes or breaks it.
Absolutely.
That if you choose to continually fill yourself with joy, and I am not perfect, I will be the first one to tell you that I'm not perfect, but that's what I feel is working for me right now.
Yeah.
And there could be a moment where, you know, maybe I need that hope list again.
Right.
But as for right now, for me and my family, it's more than the hope list. It's about, it's becoming less and less about the trial that we went through and more about this evolution of this people that we have become.
And the way you want to live. This has shaped the way you want to live as a family and the people that you want your other children to become. And the way
exactly.
that you want to live out your legacy that you're going to leave someday. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ugh.
And so, you know, in my heart of hearts, I would love to be, you know, like an inspirational speaker to just.
Well, I think you could do just that. You are amazing.
Just in their depths.
Yeah.
And just hold their hand and look in their eyes and in their heart and say, you can do this.
You're going to be okay. There
you're
is
gonna be
tomorrow.
Okay.
Tomorrow
and
we
I
live.
Promise.
Yeah,
I promise. Our track records for getting through difficult things are 100%.
As long as you
we're
get up
here,
the next day. Yep.
You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
we just keep going. We just keep doing. It's hard, and absolutely, but we can do these hard things, and we don't have to do them alone. We can do them with support, and that's what's so fabulous about being alive today in this current day and age is that having all of this current dialogue and this wonderful podcast and like your platform for empowering and helping mothers, I think is such a nurturing and such a, you know, a flock fulfilling thing that we all need to be helping each other. And that's what I just love about it. And so I'm just so happy to be here and to be a part of it.
Oh, Jackie, you're so amazing. I mean, you've just, wow. That's been a lot of food for thought. That is just so amazing. I want to read one thing that you wrote in the post where you were talking about Mathis's final morning. You ended with this. This isn't super personal. So it says, I never felt like I did anything out of the ordinary. I felt like every parent would do the same thing for their child. I was just being a mama. And I think that's it.
Yeah.
When we're being a mama, when we're being there for our child and doing anything and everything we can to make them comfortable, to make them happy, to make them learn, to make them grow, when we're doing those things, that it may seem ordinary, but that is when we are extraordinary.
Yes.
And
you
is,
know exactly
is,
what
mm-hmm.
your baby needs.
Yep. Yep.
And
you can trust
you know,
yourself in that. Mm-hmm.
And the other day I sat there, you know, looking at the image on your website, this extraordinary,
mm-hmm.
and we you know, in our own rights, we are just ordinary.
Yeah,
but,
we are.
You know, it's those extra little things that make us extraordinary.
Absolutely, 100%.
And that's what I love. And you know, it could be me, you know, holding somebody up one day, and the next day I might need the help myself.
Yeah.
I might say, you know. Can you get a hand, sister?
Yeah,
I need some help up.
And there's power in giving yourself that permission to
yes.
be to feel vulnerable. Because when
yes.
you're vulnerable, people feel more comfortable being vulnerable with you.
Right.
And that reciprocal relationship can be there. Oh, Jackie, you're just so amazing. I just want to finish with one final question.
Yes.
What would you tell your pre-motherhood self?
throw your planner style out the window.
And as a planner, that's really saying something, right?
It is.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you think motherhood is going to be is going to blow your mind. You have no idea, yet you have a glimpse of an idea. Mm. And there's no other way to really describe it, because you kind of know what you're getting into, and yet you have no idea what you're getting into.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and I am human. I struggle with the wishing away the moments. Mm. Oh, I can't wait till this. Wait till this. And I have to continually stop myself and go, you know, no, I can wait.
Right.
I'm going to snuggle this baby, or I'm going to teach him how to tie his shoes for the 25,000th time.
Right.
And one day, it's going to stick.
And that's going to feel good.
And going to tie his shoes by himself. And I won't have to say, tie your shoes. Your shoes are untied. Tie your shoes.
Jackie, can I just tell you, I only buy Velcro. I will not buy lace shoes. I just don't even want to go there.
In fact, we had to buy shoes just last week because he's gone from a size 1 in August to a size 3.
Oh.
Yes, fancy that.
Oh, how about that?
And I was so tempted. And it was the strength of my husband. And I said, I just want to buy the Velcro. I really want to buy the Velcro. And we stood there at the shoe store. And he goes, we can't buy the Velcro. He's got to learn how. Otherwise, he's never going to learn
how. Yeah, right.
And I said, you're right.
Got to put in the work.
We have to buy the laces.
Yep. No, totally. Like that last pack of diapers before you really complete potty training. Yes. You're like, it would be so much easier just to one more pack of diapers. Then I'll try again.
Yes,
I mean, how many times do you want to restart?
Potty training is...
That's a whole nother podcast.
Yes, but it is a whole entity unto itself.
Yes.
Like if... is... Talk about thinking you know what you're doing and realizing
being humble.
Have no idea what you're doing is definitely what it is.
100%.
And you realize... I think that's kind of a good analogy, because with potty training, it really has... not as much to do with you as you think it does.
Yep.
Because here you are, and you're trying to, you know, train them and show them the way, but really it comes down to their will.
Absolutely.
To both their mental and physiological connection, and then their desire to do it.
Yep.
And if they don't have the desire, let me tell you, with one of mine, he just said, nope. I'm not going to do it.
Yep.
And I said to myself, well, my first one did it at 2.5. Why can't this one do it at 2.5? And he just said, nope, not happening. And one day he woke up and said, I don't want to wear diapers anymore. And I said, okay, we won't. And we potty trained that day.
That is exactly.
Did I prepare for it?
Nope. But that's exactly what happened with Austin. And it was 3 days before preschool, and he had to be potty trained. And I'm like, we are going to get kicked out of preschool before this even starts. Like, this is not working. But he did it, just in the nick of time, and he's been fine ever since.
And it's something that you probably agonized over.
Oh, my goodness.
And then you realize, like, ah, oh, could you just have saved me that anxiety?
Exactly.
But no, I think that's what it's all about, is that these older mothers and these older women that have that wisdom.
Perspective.
Mm-hmm. And they have that perspective that says, you know, they're just going to do it when they're going to do it.
Right.
And we, as younger mothers, go, you know, maybe they're going to do it when I'm going to do it. And they just sit back and smile because they know that the kid is going to do it when the kid wants to do it.
Uh-huh.
And whether it aligns with your timetable or not is, you know, neither here nor there.
Right.
And so that's why I love having friends that are more seasoned.
Yeah.
That know. And I love it.
I do too. There's so much we can learn from all the mothers around us and these stories, and I have no doubt that anyone that hears your story, Jackie, will just feel, I mean, not only, you know, compassion for you, but also just the lessons that you've learned and the way that you've handled such devastating times in your life and the way that you've spun it to create this meaningful life. We can all take that. We don't have to have that devastating diagnosis in our life in order to live a life like that.
Right.
You know,
and
we don't have to wait for that.
It's not necessarily in the cards for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it doesn't have to be your truth or your reality,
right?
But you can see that it happened to be mine, and
right.
it happened to be my truth and my reality, and how, you know, how we chose to do it, and it definitely was a choice,
right?
It
right.
was a conscious, active choice, and you know, it's just decisions that we make every day that make all the difference.
Absolutely,
and you know, and we're not perfect. We slip up, and
but then you
go, you know,
but then you go, and then you wake up the next day, and you live.
Yep, you
just
do.
Try again,
and you realize that you know, so it was a mistake. We're here to live and learn, and grow and get better, and it's about progress and not perfection.
And you have a little baby, a little floppy yep. baby to think about every time
yep.
you appreciate the smallest things in your daily life.
Oh, yes. I don't look at, when I look at babies that hold their head up, I think, oh, this is a miracle.
Yeah.
You people have no idea.
I know. And when was the last time we applauded that? Exactly.
You know, and so yep. those little teeny, teeny, tiny things are all these glimmers. And, you know, it just paves
Absolutely.
That yellow brick road.
Absolutely. I'm going to paste all the links to the things we've talked about, and I'll also include pictures of your family and sweet angel baby Mathis. Thank you,
Miss Jessica,
so much for talking with me, Jackie. We're going to split this into two episodes because it's just so good. There's just so much goodness here, and thank you for being so vulnerable and for sharing this, your personal story. And I know that the people listening, whether they've gone through something hard like this or not, we've all gone through things, and your story is just one of the power of perspective and of positive thinking and of choosing to live. Tomorrow I'm going to live. And that just really hit me. So thank you, Jackie. You're amazing. Your kids are darling. And you're an extraordinary mom. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Hey, thank you. And I think the same about you.
Oh, you're sweet. All righty. Have a good night.
Bye. You too.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Jackie Shakespeare. She is just such an extraordinary mom to me and just such an encouragement and inspiration. So I just want to thank Jackie again for being on the show. And next week we have an awesome episode. Allison Faulkner of The Allison Show will be with us, and she will talk with us about business and motherhood and what a great mom looks like. It's a really fun episode, and I can't wait to share that with you. So I'll see you next week.